to the New Year edition of the Yes to Life show. I'm Robin Daly, show host and founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, that for 18 years now has been on a mission to improve cancer care in the UK by promoting integrative medicine, a holistic approach that seeks to support people physically, mentally and spiritually. My guest today is a regular on the show and always popular. In fact, this is her sixth appearance over the last 6 years, is Kirsten Chick. Kirsten is a nutritional therapist specialising in cancer support, and she embodies the integrative approach in the way she seeks to address body, mind and spirit through her support. I'm speaking with Kirsten over the internet at her home in Sussex. Brilliant to have you back on the show, this first show of 2022.
Happy New Year, very lovely to be back.
So the last time you were on was to introduce your fantastic book, Nutrition Brought to Life, which I hear has just gone for a second printing, so well-deserved congratulations for that.
Thank you very much.
Today I want to home in on a topic that I know you have a lot to say about and that you cover extensively in your book, the kind of psychology of nutrition. By that I mean our psychological and emotional relationship to food, how that plays into all aspects of cancer, like getting it in the first place, getting through treatment, and restoring and maintaining health and well-being after treatment. So can we start with the arena of food as a promoter of chronic disease, including cancer? So rather than looking at the kind of classic healthy or unhealthy foods as the tabloids are so obsessed with doing, I'd like to ask you about any unexamined relationships with food which you feel could be underpinning the current epidemic of chronic ill health.
Yeah, so that's quite a broad question. And I think something that I come back to time and time again when talking about what underpins cancer and chronic disease generally is inflammation. So we now have a host of studies that show that inflammation is a key driver of cancer. And there are various aspects of diet and nutrition that can promote inflammation. So that's what I spend a lot of my time doing, is trying to reduce inflammation for people, or help them to reduce inflammation in their bodies. So there are a number of things that I've identified as being key nutritional and non-nutritional drivers for inflammation. And one that I keep coming up against time and time again is just general pollution and the general toxic load that we have in modern lifestyles. And that's partly diet-related, so it's to do with things like the pesticides and fungicides and other chemicals that are in the food chain because of the way that we farm, generally. So I do encourage people eat organic where at all possible. This isn't always possible for everybody, so it's really got to be a case of where you can do this. Try and get foods that's either certified organic, or you know that the source it's come from is as close to that as possible. Sometimes farms are producing food that's even better than some of the certified organic stuff out there. They've just not jumped through the expensive hoops to get there. So really looking at where your food comes from, buying the best quality possible. And that's not only going to help individually. So, for example, if I choose to eat some organic apples as opposed to non-organic apples, or some organic berries as opposed to, or even wild berries as opposed to non-organic, not only am I reducing the toxic load that goes into my body in terms of pesticide, fungicide residue on those plants, but also I'm not funding the type of farming that puts all of that into the soil, into the atmosphere, and generally contributes to everybody's poor health. It's not just about the farming industry, though. It's about traffic pollution, air pollution, plastic pollution, all sorts of things. But if we're just sticking to the realms of food and nutrition today, that's a good area to start.
Okay, so a kind of psychological hurdle, if you like, to that is many people don't buy organic food, not because they can't afford to, but simply they think, well, why should I spend the extra money on this stuff? Is it that important? And obviously you think it's that important, but many people still don't, and many people are very happy to just wheel their trolley around the supermarket buying all the bargains with no attention whatsoever to what they're actually buying in terms of the additives and pollutive ingredients. So that is a hurdle that people need to overcome in your book in order to improve their overall well-being, improve their chances of not getting some kind of chronic condition later on.
Absolutely. And you've touched on two hurdles there. I mean, there is the financial issue for a lot of people.
Yeah.
There are schemes out there that can really be helpful. So if people are kind of financially poor but not time poor, so if they have some extra time or extra energy that they can spend, then there are schemes popping up all over the place, such as community allotments, community gardens, other kind of food sharing projects where you can get access to organic produce by helping to grow it. There's a veg box scheme in Brighton called Very Local Food Hubs, where they provide high quality, low cost food boxes to people, so people can access a certain amount of organic produce and so on. But of course, a lot of that takes time, effort, energy, and some people don't have those things either, especially people in chronic poor health. So there's a lot of reasons why people don't have access to organic food. But if people do have the finances to buy it, then absolutely, I think they should. And there is this mentality that we should get everything as cheaply as possible so that we have more money to spend on the luxuries or more money to save for a rainy day. Especially, we've just been through a couple of years of a situation where we might now all be thinking, oh yeah, no, we do need to have some bigger reserves in the bank than actually we previously thought. So it's even more tempting to say, okay, spending money on food isn't a priority, it's a luxury. But if you can afford to, I don't think it is a luxury.
It's
something that we absolutely need for our health. And like I say, so that we're putting less into the environment. So it's not just a selfish thing. It's also about reducing the toxic load for everybody.
Mm-hmm. I think it's this kind of the fact that the consequences of eating badly are quite often away in the future somewhere. And it's difficult then to prioritise this. One of the things that very much contributes to all of these things we've talked about, I feel, in terms of the way we live these days, is the kind of stress and time poor way that we endure massive amounts of stress every day, and everybody's in a rush all the time. And this seems to be kind of a normal feature of life, and it's so normal that people don't even notice it, and it contributes to the poor diet that you've described, because you go out there and you buy something you can make very quickly by popping it in the microwave, and but also the actual stress itself, of course, I would say plays into the kind of inflammatory condition you're talking about. Do you want to say a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And there are multiple pathways by which stress contributes to inflammation. So one of them is, for example, that when we're stressed, we release a stress hormone called cortisol from our adrenals. And cortisol is actually an anti-inflammatory. But when we release cortisol at high levels for a long period of time, then our cortisol receptors aren't so quick to respond to it. They shut down. In the same way that insulin receptors might do with insulin resistance. So long-term high levels of cortisol can actually contribute to inflammation sticking around. So rather than inflammation being told to calm down in the body by cortisol, those messages aren't heard. Mm. So inflammation itself isn't a bad thing, actually. It's a healing response to a situation. So when we have something like a cut or an injury or an infection or a lack of protective antioxidants, for example, that create a situation of inflammation in the body, the inflammation's there to heal it, to bring some resources to the area, to create the conditions where that can be healed. And then when that's happened, when the situation's resolved, the inflammation calms down. What we're concerned about here is chronic or persistent inflammation, where it just doesn't calm down again. So one of those reasons might be because of stress, because that message that the cortisol sends to calm the inflammation down isn't being heard. Another reason is because actually there's a persistent kind of prodding of the wound, if you like. And stress can do that in all sorts of ways. And it's interesting that the way that you mentioned, Robin, about how it leads us to poor food choices. And that's something else that I've noticed for a long time. It's that thing about wanting something really quick that you can just stick in the microwave or the oven and not think too much about, which then leads people to choosing ultra-processed food. And there are now many studies connecting ultra-processed foods to inflammation and chronic illness and cancer. But also that being overwhelmed with responsibilities in life, that you just want to hand over some of the responsibility to other people. So I still hear people saying, well, if a supermarket says something is food, then it should be fit to eat, shouldn't it? Can't I just walk into the supermarket and buy anything and just know that it's going to be good for me? People want to be able to think
Fair enough. Yeah, but you can't, can you?
You should be able to.
Yeah, absolutely right. roll on the day.
Yeah, we shouldn't have to constantly be reading labels and thinking about what's in this, how's it been produced, what impact is it going to have on our bodies. We should just be able to trust. Unfortunately, we can't. And unfortunately, we need to somehow create extra headspace and time for all of that. And many people just don't have it.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, another aspect of that kind of ultra-processed food is this kind of building in of addiction, which actually manufacturers are looking to be able to do. They're looking for ways to make food addictive. And all the types of food that they're trying to make addictive are essentially in the category of not that great for you, I would say. I know, I mean, that seems to be a pretty good rule I go by.
Yeah, and just one of the things that they use to do this is sugar. Refined sugars, because you get a blood sugar hit that then sends out it sparks your brain interaction to create lots of happy, joyful, rewarded feelings. So dopamine, endorphins, all sorts of things that we get to feel really great. And then that hit is so short-lived that we then get a complete, you know, we sink again and we want that hit again straight away.
Right.
So that ties us into that addictive pattern. And sugar, refined sugar is one of the ways that we can do that. And if we're bouncing from refined sugar to refined sugar to refined sugar, again, every time we eat that refined sugar, we release a load of insulin, which is a hormone to help that sugar get to where it needs to be in the body. And that insulin is released by the pancreas. For insulin to do its job, it needs to slot into insulin receptors on the cell membrane. And insulin resistance is where those receptors stop working, so the insulin can't do its job. So we end up with high blood sugar in the blood rather than perhaps in the cells creating energy or being stored for later energy. So essentially we end up with all of this excess blood sugar and excess insulin running around the bloodstream, that causes inflammation. And that really is key. It's those refined carbohydrates, refined sugars that are creating this all of the time. And they're creating a lot of the inflammation that's underpinning chronic disease. I'm not anti-sugar. I'm not anti-refined carbohydrates. I'm anti-eating those regularly or in high amounts, because that's the impact it's going to have on the body. So for a long time, many people were saying sugar feeds cancer, for example. It's not the sugar that feeds the cancer. Sugar feeds inflammation if we're eating a lot of it and regular amounts of it. And then it's that inflammation that feeds the cancer. So we've got to weigh this up again. That's a very specific impact that those refined carbohydrates, things like white bread, white pasta, cakes, biscuits, sweets, and so on, are having on the body. But also, why are we eating them? And this is the interesting thing, because it's not that simple a choice, is it? You've mentioned the addictive qualities mm-hmm. of these. We've talked about how we don't have the headspace to think about the choices that we're making. A lot of the time, we just want to simply put the cheapest, easiest thing in the trolley and then just eat it. There's too much stress. There's too much for us to think about and be worrying about in the rest of our lives, and to also be worrying about that. It's very easy to get us hooked into these patterns. And then we end up getting blamed ourselves or blaming ourselves. We end up with a lot of self-recrimination over our eating habits and where they lead us, when actually the major blame lies perhaps with how society's been set up.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
How good are vitamin C supplements? Usually only a small proportion of vitamin C actually reaches your cells and has a positive effect. Whereas the high absorption levels of Goldman Laboratories' liposomal vitamin C help maintain optimal vitamin C levels in your body and strengthen your immune system. Now get 10% off when you choose Goldman Laboratories' liposomal vitamin C capsules. Just quote 10 off at goldmanlaboratories.com.
Do you suffer from pain? B-Cure Laser, a home-use CE-approved medical device for the effective treatment of pain, is now available in the UK. The results of a double-blind trial has shown that B-Cure Laser offers a significant reduction in pain compared to the placebo group. To get your special B-Cure offer now, call free on 0808 501 5122 or Google Radio Pro London. B-Cure Laser. B-Cure Laser.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Yeah, and with this kind of natural way that food can quite often fill a gap, some other kind of lack, which is not to do with being hungry or needing food as well, which, of course, all those kind of plans for industrialised food can play into very nicely. I mean, it can actually be excellent for business.
Yeah, completely. I mean, ideally, we don't snack. Ideally, we don't comfort eat. Ideally, we have the food that we need at the times that we need it to give us the vitamins, the minerals, the phytonutrients, and the energy and hydration that we need. And that's that. And then at other times, we really don't think about it. Mm. But there are a lot of things that scupper that. This whole blood sugar issue will scupper that, because if our blood sugar's bouncing up and down all day, then we're going to be constantly craving something to give us a little bit of instant energy to push us through the next 20 minutes or however long it is. So it's really crucial to explore ways to get those blood sugar levels really nice and stable and smooth again. But we also need to think about the emotions behind it, all the different reasons why we might be reaching for those foods. Mm. I've started asking people to think about putting together a nourish list. So having a think about all the different reasons that they might reach for the kinds of snacks that they reach to, and thinking about the times of day as well. So often for people it's mid-morning, mid-afternoon and in the evening. And getting people to think about, okay, why is it that I'm reaching for this right now? And possible answers might be because I'm hungry, or in which case it's very valid.
Fair enough. Something.
So, you know, solutions for that might be to think about, okay, so what have I had? What am I generally having early in the day? Is it enough? Am I getting enough protein in my day? Am I getting enough of X, Y, Z? You know, really having a look at, are we actually putting enough into meal times? Another valid answer might be actually because I'm thirsty. And often we misinterpret thirst as a hunger signal, whereas actually if we have a glass of water, that might actually be job done. That might be the solution. So it's often worth trying a glass of water first before having that snack. Another very valid answer to the question, why am I reaching for this snack right now, might be for comfort. It might be a stress response. It might be because there's a lack of joy in life and this food here actually brings me a little bit of joy. Mm. It might be to fill a hole. It might be boredom. All of these things are just as valid as I am hungry and I am thirsty. And I then encourage people to not deny that, to satisfy whatever reason that craving for that snack is there for, and to have a list, to create a list called their nourish list of things that might work in that situation. So, for example, if somebody knows that they always reach for a certain chocolate bar at a certain time, to have a think about, you know, could it be hunger? Could it be thirst? Could it be lack of joy? Could it be boredom? Could it be grief? Could it, you know, the things that could be. And then write a list of lots of different things that could be there instead of the chocolate bar. And that might be a savoury snack. It might be a glass of water or a cup of something. It might be an activity. It might be to call a friend. It might be to play some music. It might be to dance around the kitchen for 5 minutes. It might be to go for a walk. It might be to do some knitting or to get out the sketch pad. There are lots of different things. And then I make sure that they also put that chocolate bar on that list, because everything, that chocolate bar is as valid a response to that situation as everything else on the list. But it's good to have options. So then the next time it happens and it's that time and there's that chocolate bar craving, that person can look at the list and choose something from that list completely guilt-free, knowing that it's going to satisfy or at least help to do the job that's lacking in that moment. Yeah. And in time, maybe the chocolate bar will feature less because some of the other things have provided a bit more to resolve the reason why that's there in the first place.
Oh, interesting. Okay, that's a new kind of plan. I've never heard of that. All right, so look, I'd like to go on and look at a situation where you've received a diagnosis of cancer and maybe after a lifetime of trying to ignore those tabloid scaremongering articles, suddenly it's all piling in on you. You're terrified that everything you do or you don't eat is going to hasten an early and ugly death. And in short, your psychological and emotional relationship with food is instantly a kind of battleground of warring emotions and thoughts. So I'm sure a lot of what you've already said about general relationship to food applies equally here, but there's now this additional complexity resulting from the existential threat of cancer. So what are your first piece of advice to someone who's just been diagnosed?
Okay, so first of all, just try and ground and centre a little bit. Whatever it takes to do that, whether it's kind of going for a walk or just sitting with yourself or just having a good old laugh with a friend, that can sometimes be really grounding. And give yourself a sense that actually you have all the time in the world. I know there may be people saying to you, you haven't, but give yourself that sense that you do. I think that's really important. Because actually you don't have to do everything right now, this second. You can take your time. You can be really gentle with yourself. Actually, if you change everything suddenly overnight, that might actually be too much of a stress on your body. So a gentle, gradual approach is often the most helpful approach in any case. So be gentle and gradual about this. What you and your body needs right now is kindness, not a battleground. And all of those things you just described, Robin, so the stress, the battleground, all of those kind of things, that's a stressful place to be. The fear of the diagnosis is a lot to contend with. And to then have the fear of what you're eating on top of that, and so much fear, that's going to, you know, give you more inflammation than anything else. What we need to come away from is that fear. Fear again can be, fear and stress can be really helpful things. They can prod us into activity. But we don't want them to be freezing and create more inflammation. And I've had way too many people come into my consultation room malnourished because they're too scared to eat anything. And their immune systems are negatively impacted by this. When you're going through cancer, you want to really be giving your immune system what it needs. And that includes a lot of nutrients. So to suddenly become scared of foods really isn't helpful. I could sit here and provide an argument to as to why you should stop eating pretty much every food on the planet. That's really not helpful. No. So for most people, actually, it's about broadening your diet. It's about including so many nourishing, nutrient-dense, delicious, lovely foods that the other stuff slips away. And you don't actually have time or appetite for the other stuff anyway. So you don't have to kind of constantly be thinking about, oh my gosh, is this bad for me? Is that bad? Am I eating too much stuff that's bad for me? It's a tricky place to be. You know, many of us have been there. I've certainly been there. I definitely restricted my diet a huge amount after my cancer diagnosis. Not immediately, well, actually fairly immediately. And then I learned that actually I needed to reassess my whole relationship with food and broaden it a great deal. So there's something in every situation, whether it's something that you're eating or a place that you're sitting in, that has gifts and it has things that can be stressful. So sitting in the park or in nature, for example, it has all the gifts of being there, but you can't avoid some of the pollution that's there either, or some of the, you know, depending on where you live, being, you know, bitten by a mosquito or a spider, or, you know, everywhere has, you know, aspects to it that you that are fine, because actually the bigger picture is that sitting in nature is a wonderful thing to do. It's the same as food. So for an individual, there may be one or two foods that are really crucial to keep to a minimum, or one or two food groups for some people. It really depends on what they're going through and who they are. But for most people, really it's about eat nourishing food, and really feel your way through it as well. Trust your body, because if this is one of the reasons why I really try and encourage people to ground and center as much as possible. Because if you're grounded and centered, you can really listen to what your body's asking for. Not what your kind of sugar cravings are asking for, but what your body's really asking for. And it really will lead you the way with what you need to be eating. And to learn to trust that. And to trust your body again. Your body's not let you down at all. Nothing has let you down. So trust your body. Trust what it's telling you. And eat nourishing food.
UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
Galar Light is the quantum energy emitted from the universe, from the sun and stars. Now, Tom Palladino, a humanitarian and Scalar Light researcher, has created the world's only Scalar Light healing system, a system that can bring long-distance healing and wellness to humans, pets, and plants via a photograph. Get your free 15-day trial now at scalarlight.com. Or click on the Scalar Light banner on the UK Health Radio website.
Shields like masks are top of mind right now. But did you know you have inner armor working constantly to protect you from pathogens? It keeps you healthy and thriving. It's your immune system. Ion Gut triggers the body's natural ability to support gut strength all year long, so your immune system can protect you when you need it the most. How are you treating your inner armor? Visit uk.ionbiome.com to learn more. Ion Gut. Protect what protects you.
UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
Can I put in here, so I can imagine someone sitting listening and they've just been instructed that they need to ground and centre themselves and they're thinking... do you want to say a bit more about what you actually mean?
Yeah. So when I feel stressed, frantic, scared, it's almost like my thoughts are going round and round in circles. I can't really think straight. I'm just in a loop. I'm distracted. And I can't make clear decisions based on that. And I certainly can't feel much about the rest of my body and what it really needs and what it's really asking for. But if I was to spend some time sitting maybe in some woods with some trees or just, you know, walking along the beach and really settling into my body, perhaps, or doing some yoga or going for a run, or, you know, different things to do it for different people, or just hang out with some really good friends for a while and really settle my energy so that things don't feel quite so frantic. Things feel a bit calm and I can really feel, you know, what my gut's feeling. Then that can really help me to make decisions about what I'm eating, make decisions about what treatment path you want to follow. Those kinds of decisions as well can be really helpful. So that sense that I feel really calm, and I feel like I can really access what my body wants, what I need right now, what I need and what I want right now.
Okay, thanks for that. Just thought it was worth digging in there a little. Okay, so in a way, you've just encouraged people to take the opportunity of the diagnosis to actually have the kind of relationship to food you were describing we could all do with having. Now, I want to talk about the time when you might be going through conventional treatments, and one of the well-known features of conventional treatments for cancer is they can completely alter your relationship to food, sometimes massively, not feeling like eating at all while you're on chemo, for example. So how do you help people through these times, and what are the kind of big mistakes you can avoid?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting one again. And I think the chemo, for example, batters the digestive tract so very much. It's not surprising. It just switches your appetite off, generally. There's, you know, so much inflammation that's created actually by it, and so much dysfunction created by chemotherapy in the digestive tract. And the digestive tract will do that if it's not happy. It will say to the brain, switch off the appetite. So if somebody really needs to be keeping their weight up, their nutrients up, and they're just not feeling like eating at all, then I do encourage really nutrient-dense smoothies, not so much fruit smoothies as perhaps there might be a really good protein shake based smoothie that's got really great ingredients in it. It'll be different for different individuals, but one that I often suggest has got like a pure pea protein or hemp protein powder in. It's got some really good quality super green powders in. It's not got too much in there, so it's very simple and easy for the body to digest without having to break too much down, and lots of vitamins and minerals and other nutrients in there as well. They can be really helpful in this instance. And also, again, making sure that there's a good balance of the macronutrients in there, an appropriate balance of proteins, carbs, and lipids, fats in there, alongside vitamins, minerals, phytonutrients, but in a really simple way. And that can be much more helpful than the common kind of hospital advice to, you know, just load up on biscuits and cakes and things like that to get, I mean, I understand it. They want to get the sugar in and keep the weight up, but actually those kinds of foods are much more likely to just create more inflammation in the gut. And, so the person's going to absorb less. But we've also got to balance that with, what that person is actually desiring at that moment as well. There's a really interesting article actually in this week's New Scientist magazine, all about the psychology of food and dieting in particular. But they reference a study or an experiment from the 1970s that I haven't actually come across, where they provided people, not people with cancer, but people generally, with 2 meals. And they were looking at iron absorption, and one was the meal and one was the meal in smoothie form. And actually the people who ate the meal absorbed 70% more iron than when it was in a smoothie, which is surprising because you normally think put things in a smoothie, it's going to be easy to digest and absorb. But actually much more key to digestion and absorption is how we approach the meal. So if we're approaching a meal with anticipation and we're thinking about what we're about to eat, you know, it's often we start to salivate. That's a sign that our digestion is preparing to receive that food. And that's super, super important and all the way down. And that will be why 70% more iron was absorbed, because those people were anticipating and enjoying those meals, but not enjoying the smoothies. So when somebody's going to chemotherapy, they've got to, you know, hopefully be enjoying their nutrient-dense smoothie. But also if there's a food that they're really just going after, I give very individual advice because people are in really unique situations. So, but for some people, I might really easily say, well, just eat that food, whatever it is, but alongside it have this. Because there does need to be some enjoyment of your food. There does, it's so important to our absorption of the nutrients that we're taking in. And it's important to have joy and zest for life as well, which is so crucial.
Yeah.
Before we move on, Robin, there's just one other thing I wanted to say about that, is that actually fasting around chemo is proving to be a really successful strategy.
Right.
So it's quite interesting that actually sometimes the body wants to do that anyway. So there have been a number of studies now showing that calorie restricted or fasting itself for a few days around chemotherapy and even radiotherapy as well helps, it improves the outcomes. A lot of the study of calorie restriction and things like ketogenic programs and things like that have been done in the laboratory with rats and so on, but there have been a few human studies. And I have to say, almost everybody that I've recommended this to, and I will often recommend maybe doing a liquid fast, maybe just broths, herbal teas, vegetable juices, the day before, the day of, and the day after chemotherapy. And almost everybody has found that to be incredibly helpful in terms of side effect reduction.
Right.
And then, as I said, the studies have are promising in terms of outcomes of disease as well. So maybe it's the body also just saying, hey, just let's fast for a bit. That's the most helpful thing to do right now.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Okay, well, I'm glad you brought in that whole aspect too of the sheer enjoyment of food and what that, how important that is to our well-being all round. And of course, yeah, if you lose all joy of the food you're eating, that's not a great place to be. Okay, so moving on, one of the greatest psychological and emotional challenges of cancer is, curiously enough, is after the treatment, those who've been given the all clear. You know, that dependable body they used to have, which they expected to go on delivering day after day dependably, it's they may now feel it's not really trustworthy. You know, every little twinge, it's kind of like potentially a recurrence of cancer. And they're living in this kind of deep uncertainty about their health generally. So how can nutrition help with creating a new and a hopefully more realistic kind of security than the one which they used to have?
Yeah, it's another big question, Robin. I often relate that kind of experience to going through grief. There's so much about going through cancer that is a process that we need to grieve. Often
right.
We're grieving the loss of parts of us that have been physically cut out, or the loss of parts of us that parts of who we are that we will never be able to be again.
Right.
Loss of relationships with people who we thought would be more supportive. There's the loss of kind of life expectations and goals that we have to now readjust. There's so much that we need to grieve for.
Yes.
And the thing about grief is that it never... there's that saying, isn't there, that the grief doesn't get smaller, it doesn't disappear in time, but our lives get bigger so that we can find a space for it that's more manageable. And I think it's the same or very similar with food. So, and our sense of, can we trust our bodies again as well? How do we move forward? So to begin with, it's this massive thing that can just really have such an impact on us psychologically, emotionally. But as we move forward through life, we find a place for it. So it may be 20 years on, you're still going, oh, what's that niggle? Is it cancer? But it doesn't kind of terrify one as much as it did 20 years previously. There's a lot more perspective. There's a lot more life experience to put that in. So I think that really helps, just getting some time and distance and perspective on things. Learning to trust your body again, I think, and learning to trust that we can eat again. Again, it's a different experience for different people. I do get a lot of people saying to me, when can I just get back to eating normally? And there's a bit of me thinking, well, why would you want to? But I totally get why people would want to, because people want to just forget this happened. people just want to go back to, somebody described it beautifully recently. A client was saying that she just wants to be able to be in a situation where she can just eat and drink without thinking about it, the same way everyone else around the table is.
Mm.
Have that freedom. But, you know, once you've got that knowledge, once you've bitten the apple and you know what it's like, you can't go back to that place again.
No.
You have to find a new sense of enjoyment, a new way to enjoy your food, enjoy what you're doing with life. So that's tricky. It is tricky. It's not going to be the same as it ever was. Mm. And you've got a new relationship with your body now, as well as a new relationship with food, and that might take some time to navigate.
Mm. Well, 50% of the people sitting around the table eating and drinking as they like, of course, are going to get cancer. And they're not thinking about it too hard at the time, probably. And that is what causes the issue in a way, isn't it? It's like, you know, being in a room full of smokers. You know, it doesn't mean it's a good thing to do just because everybody else is doing it. Even though the sort of freedom, in inverted commas, to act that way may seem a desirable thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I mean, we mustn't lose sight of the issue that nutrition, diet, food isn't the only thing in terms of cancer. So people don't get cancer just because they eat poorly.
Right.
It's a part of, it can be a part of the picture. Not everybody is going to get a diagnosis, change the way they eat, and then be clear of cancer 5 minutes later. And it all goes back to, you know, everything's fine again. It's not as simple and straightforward as that. So we need to find a place for food that runs with the complexity of that. If it was as simple as, okay, if you just eat this diet for the rest of your life, it would guarantee that you would never get cancer again. Then that might be a little bit more worth the psychological effort to do that. But because it's not just diet, it's about other stresses, it's about environmental pollution, primarily, I think, actually. It's much, we need to put that all into the pot. And just remember that if you do have a situation, a meal, where you sit around and think, I'm just going to eat and drink like everybody else, that's not going to kill you.
Right.
That one incident isn't going to. So it's really, you know, knowing yourself, knowing when you need to do that and when that's actually not helpful and it's a habit. Mm-hmm. And actually you're piling on to more than your body can handle now. It's really getting to know what's going to push you over the cliff, when you're standing close to the edge of that cliff, when you're standing well back from it and you can be a bit more flexible and fluid. When you've got a handle on that a little bit, then you can feel a bit more relaxed about life.
Mm.
But it also comes with the knowledge that actually we are all going to die one day. We are all going to, you know, life isn't this thing that just goes on forever in this perfect bubble of happiness and wonder. There are layers of that in life, for sure. Mm. But there are things in this life that we need to get our head around and look in the eye and figure out how to deal with. So we need to make our own choices about how we're going to go forward with diet and respect each other's choices with that as well. So for some people, it may be really eating what we might consider to be a very clean diet every day, every moment for the rest of their lives. For somebody else, it might involve a lot more fluidity and flexibility than that. And that would depend on personality types as much as what's going on for them physically, as well as how polluted is it where they live, as well as how much stress is in their lives. All of those things we have to take into account. So how to navigate that way forward after a diagnosis is by no means a simple task. And I think a lot of people forget how much support that needs for a long time after diagnosis. You know, a lot of people are lucky enough to get an all clear at some point. And then everyone thinks, oh, right, okay, we can all get back to normal now. Their friends, their family. People don't realise how much longer afterwards some people need an awful lot of support to deal with what they've just been through.
Mm. Well, I really like something that you bring into the picture very often, which is like so often... food can get talked about in terms of what you need to avoid, you know, particularly around cancer. And you're always talking about the nourishing side of food and how people need nourishment. And I kind of think that viewing your food in that way of like, okay, I've made myself this fantastically nourishing meal, something you can actually feel good about, not just enjoy eating it, but actually feel like you're really doing everything you can to support your health at the same time. It's a great thing. It's a kind of really positive relationship to food, which, you know, with all the kind of diets and the weight problems and this, all the rest of it that goes on and the pollution of our food, it all seems to be about avoiding things most of the time. And I think that looking at the flip side of it in that way is entirely wholesome and kind of the right way to go.
Absolutely. And then we can feel that, you know, we can create these decadent meals that just feel amazing and are amazing and they taste amazing, and we don't need to feel guilty about them on any level. But we shouldn't feel guilty whatever's in the food anyway. But it helps us to get into that guilt-free head state, if you like. We're so good at feeling guilty and having a go at ourselves and beating ourselves up about food.
Yeah.
So if we can create some of these amazing nourishing meals and feel really good about them, then we can practice feeling good about ourselves in all sorts of situations.
Hmm. Okay, good message to end on. We are out of time. I knew this was going to be a fascinating talk. So why don't you tell listeners who haven't come across your book about it, how they can get a copy, which contains a lot of this great advice?
Well, it's called Nutrition Brought to Life by me, Kirsten Chick. You can get hold of it in all good online bookstores and some independent bookstores as well. So it's on all the usual kind of Waterstones, Amazon, Foyles, all of that. But also check out your local independent bookshop. If they don't stock it, then maybe ask them to get it in. It also on the alchemiapublishing.com website as well, where often they hold signed copies too. It's about 20 chapters of nutrition information and guidance and support and tips. And then there are 50 recipes at the back.
Excellent. Very good. Well, thank you very much indeed, Kirsten. A very wholesome interview, and I'll give you my best wishes for the coming year.
You too. Thank you very much, Robin. It's been an absolute joy.
Bye-bye. Bye.
If you like what you heard today, you'll love Kirsten's book, so do check it out. A reminder to secure your place at our massive two-weekend online event, Your Life and Cancer, which is on the weekends of the 29th and 30th of January and the 12th to 13th of Feb. Dozens of world-leading experts will be there addressing all aspects of integrative medicine for cancer, and all at an unbelievably affordable price. Find out more and book up at yourlifeandcancer.com. Thanks for listening. Do join me again next week for another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.